This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In a growing number of states, marijuana is legal either for medicinal or recreational use, or both. But in the eyes of the federal government, the possession and sale of the drug is illegal. Even within the federal government, there is disagreement. The Department of Justice has usually decided not to take action against marijuana users or sellers in states that have passed their own laws dealing with it. But the IRS considers anyone selling marijuana to be involved in a criminal enterprise. Around the country, attitudes toward marijuana are changing, especially when it comes to its medical use, and legislators in both Carolinas have made attempts to legalize the drug for medicinal purposes here. So far, those attempts have been unsuccessful. Today, we take a closer look at marijuana, the nation's changing attitudes toward it, and the contrary views at various governmental levels. John Hudak is the deputy director of the Center for Effective Public Management and a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution. He's also the author of Marijuana, A Short History, and he joins us from the studios of NPR in Washington. Good morning. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Later in the program, we'll hear from a South Carolina legislator who has changed his views on the legalization of marijuana for medicinal use. And if you'd like to join our conversation, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or get to us through Twitter at charlottetalks. So, John Hudak, you are a political scientist. You are not a drug or drug policy expert, although you probably know more about marijuana and marijuana policy than most people do. How did you become involved in studying our changing attitudes toward marijuana?
Well, at Brookings and at our Center for Effective Public Management, we're doing work all the time on good government, on regulation, on some of the really boring aspects of government, frankly, bureaucratic organization, personnel, things like that. And in 2012, as Colorado and Washington State were considering passing ballot initiatives to legalize the adult use of marijuana, I was approached by someone who suggested I take a look at the issue and apply the types of questions I ask regularly in my other work to this issue. And it turned out to be a pretty good bit of advice because these two states legalized marijuana for adult use and had to set up a pretty complex, rigorous regulatory program for this new product very quickly. And it allowed me an opportunity to ask a lot of very interesting questions. And then sort of away we went in growing a research program around marijuana of all types and asking a variety of questions.
What kind of questions do you ask when it comes to things, policy questions like how to treat marijuana?
Well, there's so many excellent questions out there right now because there's so little work that has been done on the topic. It's new public policy, at least legalization is. And so we ask questions about what are the best ways to go about building a regulatory system? What should tax structures look like? What does the disconnect between federal policy and state policy mean for the implementation of these reforms for people to get access, for patients to get access in the medical system, what it means for business owners? There are so many interesting issues surrounding this that the average American and, frankly, the average member of Congress or governor or other elected official doesn't even begin to deal with on a daily basis, that it gave us an opportunity both as researchers, but also with the prestige of the Brookings Institution to make some of these issues a bit more mainstream and get people talking and thinking about them.
Attitudes, public attitudes about marijuana are changing, and they're changing pretty rapidly when you come right down to it. But it's not the first time this has happened because marijuana used to be legal. Alcohol used to be illegal. Both are drugs. Both are used recreationally. Why have we treated these drugs so differently over the last 100 years? Or so, and they're kind of if the right word is inverse proportion, I think.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So I write in my book, Marijuana, A Short History, about how we got to where we are. And you're absolutely right. In the 1800s, cannabis was something that was prescribed as for medical purposes. Alcohol was too. Of course, prohibition came and outlawed alcohol, and along the way, restrictions on marijuana began to tighten very slowly over the course of the 20th century until it was formally outlawed in 1970 through the Controlled Substances Act. But many would argue that despite the harm that alcohol has on our society, it made its way back to being legal after the repeal of prohibition. But all along the way, marijuana remained, or as I was saying, became more restrictive until finally it was outlawed.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about the history in your book, when you talk about the history of our attitudes toward marijuana, you bring up a name that I'd never heard before. I'm going to say that it's been lost for most people in the mists of history. And that name is Harry Anslinger, a man who you say was the nation's first real drug czar and who was the J. Edgar Hoover of drugs. Who was this man and why did he feel he needed to launch a campaign against this drug, marijuana?
Harry Anslinger is, as you said, a fairly anonymous individual in American history, particularly for people outside of the drug policy community, but he had more of an impact on drug policy in the United States than anyone else. He got his start, well, first, he was a federal bureaucrat his entire life, and he started in the Bureau of Prohibition, and he eventually took over a series of agencies that were the forefathers, if you want to say, of the DEA. And he was on a crusade to make drugs illegal, to criminalize their use, and he had a particular place in his heart for marijuana. He launched what was an aggressive campaign in states, in front of Congress, and in newspapers across the country that was based on flawed data, in some cases made-up data.
Did he know it was made up? Did he know it was flawed?
Oh, yeah, he made it up himself. and a campaign that was dripping in racism. The language that came out of his office and from his lips were very divisive, were very racist in nature, and tried to pit white Americans against non-white Americans. And ultimately, he was successful in achieving what he wanted to achieve, and that was to outlaw drugs.
Yeah, he associated marijuana use with Mexicans, the Mexican and the black communities.
That's right. It began first after the Spanish-American War as something that Mexican immigrants were using in the southwest of the United States and then elsewhere. And the language was that of a classist and racist real division. In fact, the word marijuana, some people in the drug policy community will not even use that word. They prefer to use cannabis, because the root of it was in this Mexicanization of the plant. And later on, it became associated with the jazz movement, which was code word for the African-American community. And ultimately, Anslinger built fear and hatred into drug policy in the U.S.
He claimed that marijuana would turn people into psychopaths, murderers, rapists. It would increase promiscuity, particularly of white women when they were reproached or in the company of black men. That sounds like the old movie Reefer Madness. Is that were his ideas the source material for that film?
Oh, absolutely. Harry Anslinger had almost a monopolistic control over information about drugs in the United States. He fed local community organizations. He fed media. He fed other elected officials this information about what drugs were doing in the community. And that became not just the bedrock of American public policy. In many ways, it became the bedrock of American public thought with regard to drugs and particularly marijuana. And yes, it fed to script writers who wrote Reefer Madness and a series of other films and propaganda campaigns over the decades.
Did anyone challenge him on his incorrect facts, on his false or alternative facts at the time?
Absolutely. There were quite a few people, and not just, lunatics on the fringe. Fiorello LaGuardia, who later became mayor of New York, he challenged him by having a public health commission investigate claims about drug use, particularly marijuana use, in New York City, and found Anslinger's data and information to be wildly flawed, both about the prevalence of use and the effects of use. The LaGuardia Commission concluded that marijuana was not as addictive as as Anslinger was saying, and that it was not as prevalent in the community as he was saying, and that the effects, these psychotic episodes and other types of effects, did not bear out in public health studies. He was shut down, the study was scrapped, and he was vilified in the media by Anslinger. But all along the way, there were studies. Eisenhower organized a study. Kennedy organized a study. Nixon organized studies. And every time they came back and told the U.S. government what they didn't want to hear. And as a result of that, those commissions largely got thrown in a drawer and forgotten about.
The last one you talked about, Richard Nixon, he had his friend, the governor of Pennsylvania, Ray Schaefer, oversee a study on the effects of marijuana. And Ray Schaefer came back reporting that marijuana was not as addicting as previously thought, and that there were reasons to try to think about it in different ways. And he said that it wasn't causing violent crime. And he published the report in spite of Nixon saying, I don't want it published because it didn't adhere to what Nixon's preconceived notions were about this. That didn't have any impact?
It really didn't. In fact, Governor Schaefer was called into the Oval Office, and the president read him off and begged him not to publish the study. And Schaefer was an honorable man and a good public servant and someone who was interested in the truth. And he respectfully told the president he was moving forward with the commission and with the report. And for Nixon, it wasn't just that it didn't comport with his preconceived notions. That's certainly correct. But Nixon had a political strategy in place that was focused on pitting what he considered good Americans against bad Americans. And that was a political strategy that got him elected in 1968, and it got him reelected in 1972. This report came out in 1970 as Nixon was staring down reelection. And as we know, Richard Nixon stopped at nothing to try to enhance his chances of getting reelected in 1972. And Watergate and drug policy were two peas in a pod in a lot of ways.
So we have this man, Harry Anslinger, from the Prohibition era, who is slinging all this inaccurate information about marijuana, who's had a long-lasting effect on our policy toward that drug. And we have a series of reports done by reputable people that have pretty much put to rest any question of accuracy on the part of Harry Anslinger. We also have a lot of white, middle, and upper-class people who have used this drug for years, and that includes presidents and members of Congress. So why the hypocrisy here?
Well, there is still fear around drug policy in the United States, and there's fear of reforming it. Drug policy in the U.S. has been wildly ineffective by any metric. It's true for marijuana. It's true for a variety of drugs, really all drugs. But members of Congress, other elected officials, presidents, governors, they fear that if they change drug policy in some way, that they will be blamed for the outcome. Now, I think there's plenty of blame to go around in this country for what has happened with the opioid crisis and the failure of the United States Congress, of state legislatures, and others to address this issue earlier on. But that is not how the mind of an elected official thinks. And it's a real problem in this country.
We're talking to John Hudak, who's the Deputy Director of the Center for Effective Public Management and a Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution, who has done a lot of research into the history and the background of marijuana and its effects on people. And he's the author of Marijuana, A Short History. We will continue our conversation in just a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Baby & Company, a modern birth center offering individualized maternity and well-woman care, classes, and wellness services in an intimate setting. More information available at babyandcompany.com. And NC Warn, working to slow climate change by curbing methane emissions from the fracked gas and power industries. Information on clean energy alternatives at ncwarn.org. For 2 weeks, parents of CMS students have been dissecting Superintendent Ann Clark's recommendations for new school boundaries, and a public hearing will be held tonight in advance of a school board vote at which parents will give their feedback. We will update you on what happened tomorrow morning at 9, and then despite grocery store wars in Charlotte's more affluent areas, some neighborhoods lack access to fresh, healthy food. We hear about the city's efforts to change that tomorrow as well at 9.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, Sally Yates testifies on General Michael Flynn. We'll look at the latest on the Russia connection. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
You can join On Point from 10 to noon right after Charlotte Talks. Here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. John Hudak is our guest, the author of Marijuana, A Short History, and the deputy director of the Center for Effective Public Management at the Brookings Institution. He joins us from studios in Washington, D.C. We've gotten a little history lesson here on this country's attitudes toward marijuana, both in policy and in terms of public attitudes. But just to give you an idea of how serious this is, the government takes it at least, at the federal level, marijuana is a Schedule I substance. It's in the same category as heroin and ecstasy. Schedule I drugs are considered the most dangerous drugs and those with no medicinal use. What other drugs, John, fall into that category other than the ones that I've mentioned?
Well, those are the big ones. There are a variety of drugs in Schedule One that most people have never heard of. But right. Yeah, heroin, ecstasy, other psychedelics are in Schedule One. In fact, cocaine, which you might think is in Schedule One, actually sits in Schedule Two because the government considers medicinal value for certain uses of cocaine. But marijuana is in that same category as some of the harshest drugs, some of the worst opioids.
Well, you know, societies for years, thousands, millennia, have used cannabis for medicinal purposes. So how did cannabis find its way into Schedule One?
Well, the purpose of Schedule One, the purpose of all of the drug schedules, is to create a regulatory regime around drugs. And that was put into place by the Controlled Substances Act in 1970. But that law was a means of the U.S. government to come into compliance with an international treaty obligation called the Single Convention on Narcotic Drugs. That convention sought to put all drug policy in the U.S. all drug policy across the world on a similar wavelength so that member nations were dealing with these issues in similar ways. The challenge, though, is that marijuana became this outlandishly vilified product over the years. The treaty was negotiated in the 1960s, but this was after decades of American leadership on marijuana suggesting that it was this psychosis-inducing plant. And that made its way, of course, it should be no surprise that the United States had leadership power in this treaty negotiation and ultimately put marijuana in Schedule One among these most dangerous drugs. Now, that said, the treaty does have exceptions for medical use and for scientific research, but the U.S. government has failed to make that exception for medical use thus far.
And despite that, 29 states plus the District of Columbia have legalized marijuana for medical use now. 8 states and Washington, D.C. have legalized it for personal use, and yet the federal government views possession of it as a federal crime. How unusual is it for states to take a different stand on something that is a federal crime?
It's not uncommon for states to take a different stand from the federal government. We saw this on things like same-sex marriage. We've seen it for things like speed limits and other issues. But for a state to openly defy federal law is fairly unprecedented. Like I said, in the federal system we have, states can do their own thing, but the one thing they can't do is violate the federal law under the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution. So this is extraordinarily unprecedented and sort of new ground in terms of policy.
So what's driving that for them to thwart the government, the federal government?
Well, states and advocacy organizations within states, individuals, patients are fed up with a federal government that is failing to catch up with science, that is actively holding back the conduct of that science. And frankly, there are a lot of individuals who, as you said at the top of the show, have used marijuana have seen that it does not cause that kind of psychosis. And for hundreds of thousands of Americans, they use marijuana and they're seeing medical value. Hmm. And so states are stepping up to change in a way that the federal government refuses.
We're going to talk about medical value on this show in a few minutes here. And we've done previous programs about the medical use of marijuana and with a legislator in this state who has tried on several occasions to get a law through the legislature, or a legislature allowing medical use of cannabis. But there is this other side, and that is the fact that a lot of people like marijuana for one reason and one reason only. It gets them high, and they like to be high. And that is why some people consume alcohol. They like the feeling. Is the prejudice against getting high part of what informs government policy on marijuana?
That's absolutely right. And in the marijuana reform community, for instance, there is an active effort to try to decrease the stigma around getting high. In some conversations, in some policy conversations, a lot of people talk about everything else about marijuana except that. But as you said, for many people, that is the point. For some people, it's the point of drinking. For some people, it's the point of running. They get a runner's high from it. And for marijuana users, yeah, for adult users, that is, in many cases, the purpose. And it's a difficult stigma to overcome, and the reform community is trying to overcome it not simply by saying, well, people should be able to get high if they want to, but by talking about responsible use, not smoking and driving, not smoking if you're breastfeeding, not smoking if you are at work or operating heavy machinery, in the same way that you would talk about using prescription medications or alcohol.
How addictive is this drug, and is it a gateway drug?
Well, I'll answer the second question first. It is not a gateway drug from a chemical perspective. That has been fairly soundly undermined as government propaganda. It can function as a – it can have a gateway effect on an illegal market in particular. As you go to a drug dealer to get marijuana, which has actually a very low profit margin for a drug dealer, and they try to turn you toward harder drugs. In that case, it's a sociological environment that serves as the gateway effect and not some chemical predisposition or chemical part of marijuana. In terms of its addiction, I think there are some in the marijuana community, reform community, who will tell you it is not addicting. That is false. Marijuana does have addiction disorders. And it happens in about 1 in 10 users, which is lower than alcohol. It's lower than opioids. It's lower than nicotine. But there are dependence. There is a dependence that can happen in a subset of users.
Is there – all drugs have side effects, all of them. Are there deleterious side effects to marijuana, and are they controlled with the way you ingest it? In other words, are you at risk of getting lung cancer if you smoke it? Does something different possibly happen to you if you ingest it in a baked good?
So I'll preface this answer with two points. First, I'm not a medical doctor.
Okay.
And two, the research on the health effects of marijuana is incomplete because the federal government has made it so hard to study marijuana in this country. But from the information that we have, there is very little relationship between marijuana use and cancers and pulmonary cancers. There is evidence that it can cause irritation and other kinds of issues like bronchitis, like chronic bronchitis or throat irritation if you are smoking it. If you're vaping it, if you're using edibles, of course, that goes away. Then there are other types of effects like issues with short-term memory while you're using it, which should, if you've ever been high before, that isn't much of a surprise. The jury is out on any kind of long-term memory or cognition problems with use, in large part because users vary, just like they do with alcohol. There are people who use very heavily marijuana or alcohol, and there are people who use occasionally. It's true for marijuana. It's true for alcohol. And so, yeah, the manner of ingestion and, of course, the frequency of ingestion will affect those types of side effects.
You mentioned that studying marijuana has been made very difficult by the federal government. In order for scientists and universities to study the medical effectiveness of marijuana or the effects of marijuana, they have to go through the federal government to get access to it. The DEA has what some have called a mandated monopoly. You have to get the drug through them from a farm at the University of Mississippi. I'm not sure how that came to be. But why? Because there are now states where the drug is legal medicinally and it's legal for recreational use. Why can't universities and other research scientists simply go to those states, buy as much of the drug as they want, and do research on it?
This is a very complicated process in public policy, and everything you said is exactly right. There are restrictions on security and certification for individuals to be in a lab that is studying marijuana. It is an expensive and arduous process. And then, of course, once you jump through all of the hoops of having your lab ready and actually getting a study approved, you then have to purchase the marijuana, the research-grade cannabis, from this farm at the University of Mississippi. It is a DEA-mandated monopoly that is administered by the National Institute on Drug Abuse. Now, that said, in August, DEA issued a rule that broke that monopoly, that said other research facilities can apply to become federally certified growers of research-grade cannabis. None of those applications have been approved. The last I heard, there were about a dozen schools, largely schools, that were trying to get those, but none have been approved yet. And because you are required to get it from that source, you can't just go to the dispensary or one of the growers in Colorado or Washington and enter into an agreement.
So is it more difficult or simply as difficult to study the medical effectiveness or the medical effects of marijuana as it would be to launch a study on the medicinal properties of cocaine or heroin or some other drug?
Well, it's easier to do work on those other products because for cocaine, it's a Schedule II drug, so some of the requirements for what a lab has to be like are slightly relaxed compared to a Schedule I drug. For many of the other drugs, particularly synthetic drugs, you can get those produced in any lab, really, that produces chemical products. That requirement to get marijuana from the grow operation at Ole Miss is unique to marijuana in no other drugs.
So 29 states have recognized marijuana for its medicinal purposes. You can use it in those states legally, at least according to the state. Has the medical efficacy of marijuana ever been proven, given all these stumbling blocks that the federal government has put in place?
Well, to prove medical efficacy is in some ways in the eye of the beholder. So the medical community has very high standards to prove medical efficacy, but for the casual user, for a medical marijuana user, if it works for them, then that's proof to them that it works. For the medical community, it's a little more complicated. And the challenge for marijuana is that it is used for so many different ailments at the state level that to be able to prove, according to the medical community standards and federal standards, that it meets the requirement for medical efficacy, in many cases requires numerous gold standard studies, that is, double-blind placebo studies. And there just hasn't been that much work. We have pretty good evidence that there are elements of marijuana that can help with epilepsy. We know that it can help with things like clinical anorexia, that is, people who cannot eat because of chemotherapy or HIV/AIDS or other disorders. There is evidence that it can help with things like anxiety, but it really hasn't been fully proven yet, because of the restrictions on that research.
So anecdotally, when did people begin to notice the medical effectiveness? Obviously, this goes back to thousands and thousands of years, but in America, anecdotally, when did the medical effectiveness start to be thought of as accurate?
Well, in more modern times, and this is something that I came across while doing research for my book, and I think the best discussion of this connection between noticing marijuana's medical value and it becoming part of public policy is from Bruce Barcott's book, Weed the People. And he talks about how the HIV/AIDS epidemic actually in San Francisco was the birthplace of medical marijuana in a lot of ways, because people were noticing that if they used marijuana. It helped with some of the effects of end-stage AIDS or the terrible side effects of some of the early drugs used to treat HIV/AIDS. And so AIDS wasting syndrome, where people are just too sick to eat or to keep food down, people noticed that if you used marijuana, either as an edible or smoked it or however it was ingested, could actually help rehabilitate people's appetites, and that could help those patients live longer or have a little bit of an easier time dealing with their disease. And from there, it grew to more anecdotal evidence about it helping other things like epilepsy, like anxiety disorders, pain management, and the like.
In these 29 states that have recognized marijuana for medicinal purposes, and in the District of Columbia, where it is legal both recreationally and medicinally in the home of the federal government. Is there something going on there? Do these 29 states and D.C. have something in common that led them down this path while the other states have not taken that path?
Well, early on, a lot of the states that legalized medical marijuana were ballot initiative states. As I said earlier, elected officials tend not to keep up with public opinion on this issue. And so when that vote went before voters, they were able to do what their state representatives and state senators were unwilling to do, and that was take the step forward toward reform. But that, the first state to legalize medical marijuana was California in 1996, and over the course of time, as you said, 28 more states in D.C. Legalized. Now, the only place in which there's a noticeable deficit in, or sort of a systematic deficit in legalization of medical marijuana is the American South, is a place where traditional values, the religious right, tends to coincide also with a number of states that lack the ballot initiative. And that is really the core of where medical marijuana is not. There are a few states checkered around the country elsewhere, but liberal states, conservative states, ballot initiative states, non-ballot initiative states, Northeast, South, they're all legalizing. And so really, that's the only place where it lacks.
So it's a moral issue for a lot of people because it's an illicit drug in their minds. It is not a medicinal drug. It's an illicit drug. It's a bad thing.
That's right. I think those more traditional values are true, and the unwillingness to get away from what has been decades of government propaganda.
I grew up in D.C., and there was always this talk about a lack of home rule in Washington, D.C. The Congress runs the District of Columbia, although there's a mayor and council system. The Congress makes all the money decisions. That's all at risk with this legalization, isn't it? How do they get away with it? I only have 30 seconds here, but how do they get away with it?
Well, Congress has not stepped in any way to affect the medical system in D.C., but after D.C. legalized through initiative adult-use marijuana, Congress stepped in and said that the government of D.C. can't use any money to implement the system.
John Hudak is Deputy Director of the Center for Effective Public Management and a Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution and also the author of Marijuana, A Short History. Short, but fascinating. We're going to take a break. We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Corkscrew Wine Shop and Bar. New location now opened at The View in downtown Charlotte near BB&T Ballpark. Full portfolio of wine and beer from all over the world, plus live music. Details at thescrewcrew.com. And Goodwill Industries of the Southern Piedmont, dedicated to breaking barriers to employment, training, job seekers, and offering health care and banking at the Goodwill Opportunity Campus. Information at goodwillsp.org. The controversy surrounding President Trump's former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn returned to the forefront as former Acting Attorney General Sally Yates told the Senate yesterday that she warned the White House about Flynn's relationship with Russia weeks before Flynn was eventually fired. The latest on the possible Russian connection, On Point with Tom Ashbrook, coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. And if you'd like to join our conversation, email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks.
There's a new sheriff in town in the Texas State House.
Now, this law can lead to jail time for any official who refuses to comply with the ban on sanctuary cities.
Texas Governor Abbott wants to enforce federal immigration regs. Local cops cry foul. That's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International.
The Takeaway coming up at 2 on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the government's marijuana policy at the federal and state levels because 29 states have legalized it in some form, whether it's for medicinal or for recreational use. And that includes the District of Columbia, which has done it for both uses of marijuana. John Hudak is our guest, the author of Marijuana, A Short History, and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. We hope by the end of this program, before the end of this program, to have with us a South Carolina Republican legislator who has changed his mind about the medical use of marijuana in that state. And we hope to hear from him. He's been called into a meeting with the Speaker of the House down there just as we were about to go to him, so we'll see if we get him back. And if you'd like to join our conversation, you are welcome to by emailing us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or get to us through Twitter at charlottetalks or WFAE on Facebook. A recent CBS News poll shows support for legalizing marijuana as higher today than ever before. 61% of Americans believe marijuana use should be legal. 88% favor medical marijuana use. 71% oppose any attempt by the federal government to stop marijuana sales in states where it has been legalized. And yet, White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer told reporters in February that the Trump administration had no plans to continue the, quote, permissive approach of the Obama administration, and that the new administration views recreational marijuana use as a flagrant violation of federal law. Do we know if that extends to the use of the drug for medicinal purposes?
The Congress has really battled with this issue over the course of the past several years, and they don't have enough support in Congress right now to have any type of full-fledged legalization for medical or recreational use. And so the Congress passed a rider to an appropriations bill that restricted the Department of Justice from using funds to enforce the Controlled Substances Act in states that have legalized marijuana for only medical use, not for adult use, but for medical use, and against firms that are complying completely with those state laws. Now, the federal government is in a difficult position in that case because they have a law to enforce and, in Justice's case, no money to enforce it. But so far, the government has complied with that spending provision. It was renewed in the latest continuing resolution, so it will be good through September. And that has been how marijuana advocates in the Congress have created this sort of stasis, at least from a legislative perspective.
Attorney General Jeff Sessions, during his confirmation hearings, suggested the Justice Department might prioritize certain marijuana offenses over others. And he questioned the medical value of cannabis, even in the face of research from the University of Michigan and elsewhere that directly contradicts his beliefs. He said it is a more dangerous drug than people believe. That's a quote. Is it?
It is probably not a more dangerous drug than people believe. Jeff Sessions has a very troubling relationship with the facts and with reality. And I think when it comes to medical and scientific data, he gets very confused very quickly. And so his language at the confirmation hearings were those of an individual who was raised in a society that had a very stark view on marijuana, and he never let new facts and new reality interrupt what he learned as a child. And so I think really what you heard at his confirmation hearing were the words of a child. You would want public policy to be more informed, and to the Attorney General's credit, he has not so far cracked down on the marijuana industry or put those types of words into action.
That sounds what you just said sounds very partisan and very political. So I have to ask you, does this come from a partisan point of view, or does this come from what you know about marijuana and the research that you've done on marijuana through for the Brookings Institution and for your book, Marijuana, A Short History?
Sure, it's not partisan at all. There's Democrats and Republicans who repeat the same nonsensical language that science has proven to be wrong. It's not something that is true of Republicans. It's not something that's true of only Democrats. It's certainly something that's true of Jeff Sessions. But we've had a lot of elected officials and appointed officials in the Obama administration, the Bush, the Clinton administrations, and now the Trump administration who have thought this way. It's an old versus new. It's a reality versus an alternative reality.
So what do studies show about marijuana's impact on either the lungs or on the brain, particularly of young adults? Because a lot of kids start using this drug at very early ages, and we know their brains are still developing till they're about 27 if they're male.
Yeah, that's right. It is certain that young people should not be using marijuana recreationally. The developing brain should not be subject to any mind-altering substances. Now, there are certain situations in the states where they allow the use of medical marijuana for young patients who have particularly difficult medical conditions. And that makes sense because we subject young people to a lot of very dangerous pharmaceuticals if it is meant to improve their place. But states universally, at least with adult use laws, say that if you are under the age of 21, you are not allowed to legally access the system. And that's a good thing. Young people should not be using this. But of course, marijuana legalization doesn't introduce marijuana to those states. It is there. And what people in the marijuana reform community often say, and I think it's right, is that drug dealers don't check IDs, but dispensaries in Seattle and Denver and elsewhere do.
But evidently, in those states where this is legal, either for recreational or medicinal use, that has not stopped the underground trade in marijuana, partly because when you go to a dispensary, it's taxed. And when you go to a drug dealer on the street, it is not. So it's cheaper.
Well, it is true that the legalization of marijuana has not displaced the black market. And there are a variety of reasons why the black market continues to exist. Price and tax is one of them. Another is that there are individuals who just don't want to be seen in dispensaries. They don't want to be part of that system. There are some who just don't trust the legal system. It's true that legalization is not the magic answer to a black market. But there is evidence that the black market has been displaced some, that is not as big or as strong as it used to be.
Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General, has also linked marijuana to violent crime. Is there a link?
No. There is not a link. There are links between drug dealers who may be selling marijuana in addition to other drugs. And violent crime, obviously, drug cartels engage in that type of violent behavior. But there is no legitimate evidence that the casual marijuana user and someone using only marijuana is going out and robbing banks or committing murders or raping women or anything like that.
In the case where cannabis is legal for medicinal use, is it in the form that we commonly think of, this loose leaf stuff that you roll into a joint or you bake into a brownie, or is it the cannabis oil that we're talking about here fundamentally?
That depends on from state to state. So there are some states that have what you might call a wide open system. That is, you can buy marijuana in a variety of forms, whole flower, oils, different products that are either already edibles or things that you can make into edibles, and a vaporization as well. In some states, especially a couple of new states that have come online, like Ohio, in Pennsylvania, you can't smoke it. You have to ingest it in some other way. In some states, edibles are banned. And then in some states, you can only access a certain byproduct of marijuana called cannabidiol or CBD oil that is non-intoxicating, and it can only be used for a small variety of conditions. But from state to state, these rules on how you can actually ingest it vary quite dramatically.
Let me share with you some things that have come in from listeners while we've been talking. Robert on Facebook says, I am totally clueless as to why we as a nation, or I as an individual, should be encouraging anyone to accept chemical mind alteration of this nature as anything of merit for recreational use. If there is anything of medical value for this class of mind-altering drugs, I'm open to fact-based, peer-reviewed, scientific evidence and effectively regulated administration use by the medical profession. How would you respond to that?
Well, I think the individual on Facebook falls into a category of Americans that is significant, and that is people who support medical marijuana, which has polls between 80% and 90%, but don't support adult-use marijuana, which polls at about 60%. I'm a scientist, too. I would love for marijuana to be subject to a free, scientific, rigorous investigation about its medical efficacy and medical value. But part of that is the person on Facebook is absolutely right. It hasn't happened in as rigorous a way as possible. But that also exists because government policy is restricting it. And we don't face those same barriers for other substances. And so in the face of a government that is legitimately interjecting itself between researchers and the truth, this is what we have. Is it ideal? Absolutely not. But public policy isn't ideal in this country, and in many cases, voters have taken it into their own hands.
Research or lack of research aside, polls say that most Americans believe that marijuana is safer than alcohol. Is it safer? Is it less safe? About the same? Where would you put it?
Well, I think comparing the safety of substances is a difficult question because you could look at it in terms of what are the side effects, what are the other types of conditions you might develop if you use it, what are addiction rates, what it might do to you when you're driving or operating machinery. And so I would say that you're right. Most Americans believe marijuana to be less harmful than alcohol. But every time I've seen a qualified medical doctor try to answer this question, they give pretty much the answer I just gave you. It depends on what you're looking at.
There are people who can't handle alcohol. They have an addictive personality or there's something in their body chemistry that makes them addicts when it comes to alcohol. So they are best to avoid it. Is the same true of marijuana?
Oh, certainly. There are certain people in a population who have predispositions toward addiction or toward dependence, whether that is addiction to a chemical substance, whether it is addiction to a behavior or something else entirely. There are definitely people who should avoid chemical substances like this. Some people can manage it and handle it and not have a cannabis use disorder, and there will be other people who will be subject to that.
This product, marijuana, has been used for lots of different uses, not just for getting high and not just for medicinal uses, but for the manufacture of hemp, from which almost anything can be made, evidently, because we did a program years ago in which somebody was building a hemp car. The entire car was made out of hemp. And Kenneth emails, what about the cotton growers lobbying against hemp? Hemp can be grown with less damage to soil. It can be used to make many things. The public attack on hemp as a drug was and is a smokescreen.
There are many uses for hemp. You're absolutely right. From oil to food to clothing to rope lines and pretty much everything. People in the hemp reform community will tell you that you can pretty much make anything out of hemp. I'm hesitant to jump into the discussion of certain interest groups lobbying against legalization of marijuana, legalization of hemp. My look at the funding data and lobbying information suggests that there is not that much of a smoking gun between certain interests trying to hold back a policy and a policy being held back. In reality, most elected officials just think hemp is marijuana. They're wrong, but they just think it's marijuana and it's an easy way for people to quietly grow a drug. and information campaigns to inform members of Congress and others is the best first step toward changing their minds.
We had hoped to have South Carolina Republican legislator Eric Bedingfield on the program today, but he was called into a meeting and could not join us. But he has changed his mind about this drug. He used to be against all marijuana use, but now because of the death of his son from opioid addiction, he feels that perhaps some form of it should be legalized as an alternative, because he believes that this could be prescribed as an alternative to people being prescribed OxyContin or other opioid painkillers. Could that be true? Could marijuana be as effective as an opioid painkiller and less addictive?
Well, it's certainly less addictive. I can say that. But there are two streams of research going on right now with regard to cannabis and opioids. One looks at its use as a substitute. That is, can it be used for pain relief, exactly as you said, without the same types of side effects and with this, without the same proclivity toward dependence? The other is looking at using cannabis to wean people off of opioids. And there's some research out there from the University of Michigan and elsewhere that suggests that people who have an opioid addiction can help overcome it with the use of cannabis. Now, that's evidence. It's not proven. But that is another alternative use for cannabis that medical researchers see as a real opportunity to make some groundbreaking discoveries in.
Kirby emails, I only have 10 seconds, 15 seconds. The furthest the state of North Carolina has gone on this is the use of cannabis oil, but some parents seeking this for their children have said doctors are reluctant to prescribe it. Why would that be the case?
Doctors were raised in a pretty conservative discipline, and that conservatism takes a long time to go away. It's true in North Carolina, and it's true across the country.
John Hudak is Deputy Director of the Center for Effective Public Management, Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution, who concentrates on policy implementation, legislative executive relations, marijuana policy, and elections. He's also the author of Marijuana, A Short History. Thanks for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins